On the morning of January 23, 1978, Baron Edouard Ompin was snatched off the street in front of his home in Paris. The kidnappers promptly cut off his little finger and sent it to the family, along with a ransom note demanding 80 million francs, worth about $70 million today. They threatened to send other body parts unless the money was paid immediately. The French press went ballistic and called it the kidnapping of the century. There had been dozens of other kidnappings in Europe during the 1970s, the so-called decade of lead. What made this one special? The identity of the victim and the importance of his industrial empire. The Ompin Schneider Group was a sprawling multinational comprising 175 companies, ranging from transport, banking, to steelmaking, armaments, and most important, nuclear energy. It was central to French economic and security interests. So who was Baron Ompin? Edouard Ompin, Watteau to his friends, was the 40-year-old grandson of the company's legendary founder. Ompin was tall, athletic, and movie star handsome. He was rich, drove fancy cars, lived in a chateau, and vacationed on the Riviera. But he had two flaws: a weakness for high-stakes gambling and women. During his 63-day incarceration, scandalous details about his private life leaked out into the press, doing permanent damage to his reputation and ultimately triggering his downfall. The arc of Ompin's rise and fall has an aspect of Greek tragedy. It's also a multifaceted saga, spanning three generations and featuring a cast of fascinating characters. The first Baron Ompin was a self-made man built on railroads, energy, finance, and civil engineering. His exploits included the building of the Paris Metro, railroad construction all over Europe and parts of Asia, gold mining in the Congo, and the creation of a whole city on the Egyptian desert, Heliopolis, the city of the sun. His achievements led the Belgian king, Leopold II, to ennoble him with the baron's title and a freshly minted coat of arms. When the first baron died in 1929, he was one of the world's wealthiest men. The founder's eldest son, Jean Ompin, nicknamed Johnny, inherited the baron's title and his command over the Ompin industrial empire. Handsome and charming, Johnny was a hedonistic playboy who preferred cruising around the world on his yacht and throwing wild parties in his chateau to minding the office. Johnny was a boozer, a gambler, and a serial womanizer who counted Josephine Baker among his many conquests. But the woman he finally fell for was an American exotic dancer from Columbus, Ohio, Roselle Rowland. Her specialty was dancing nude, covered only by a thin coat of gold paint, hence her nickname, Goldie. Johnny married her in 1937 after she gave birth to a son, Edouard, a.k.a. Watteau, the one who would later be kidnapped. Johnny and Goldie lived the high life, throwing extravagant Gatsby-like parties at their chateau and hobnobbing with Europe's rich and famous. During the war, Johnny's guest list included high-ranking Nazi officers with whom he maintained a cozy relationship throughout the occupation. At war's end, he was investigated for collaboration, but fled the country and died of cancer before he could be tried. Finding herself cut out of the will, Goldie promptly married Johnny's impotent cousin in order to retain her title and her fortune. But she lived apart from him in her own chateau. She paid little attention to her son, Watteau, preferring the company of a famous jockey with whom she had a love child, Diane. Another fascinating character was the head kidnapper, Alain Caillol. Caillol had been born into a wealthy family, but turned to a life of crime as an act of revolt against his strict father. Caillol was educated at posh boarding schools and nurtured a passion for books and grand opera. After an early career as a burglar and bank robber, he organized a motley band of thugs and misfits with the aim of kidnapping a high-profile figure and holding them for ransom. Watteau was then at the apogee of his career, a self-proclaimed master of the universe, whose image as a super-rich capitalist made him an obvious target for the left-leaning Caillol and his band. While researching this book, I had the good fortune to enlist Caillol is a key source. Now 80 years old, a free man after spending decades in prison, Kyol told me the inside story about how his gang carried out the kidnapping, along with the fly-on-the-wall details about Watto's long incarceration and a freezing stone quarry. He also provided a first-person account of the shootout with police that left him wounded and a fellow kidnapper dead when they came to collect the ransom. Kyle's arrest led to Watto's release and set in motion the manhunt that finally netted his 8 co-conspirators. But for Watto, it was anything but a happy ending. Because of the revelations about his private life, he emerged from his long captivity as damaged goods. Lost his family and his control over the Ompin group. Within a few years, the industrial empire built by his grandfather was spun off in bits and pieces, and the very Ompin name disappeared. Sad to say, Watto never kicked the gambling habit, and it ruined him. When he died in 2018 at the age of 80, he was practically penniless. As I wrote in the preface, this is a cautionary tale about a man who threw caution to the wind. That's my 6 minutes.
Thanks, Tom. Why do we hear stories of kidnappings in the U.S. and Europe today? Watto is kidnapped in 1978, and this was part of a pattern of kidnappings.
The 1970s were riddled with kidnappings, especially in Europe, Italy, Germany, France. Also in the U.S., of course, the Patty Hearst kidnapping, which was a year or two before the Ompin kidnapping. The Getty kidnapping. Hans Martin Schleyer in Germany, who was the head of the Employers Association in Germany, a very powerful industrialist. He was kidnapped and assassinated by the Red Brigades. What you had was two different kinds of kidnapping. It was the ideological kidnapping, anti-capitalist, radical left kidnapping, and there was the kidnapping for money. Schleyer was obviously radical political kidnapping. So was Aldo Moro, former prime minister of Italy, kidnapped by the Red Brigades and assassinated. When Ompin was kidnapped, the police assumed that it was political because he was a high-profile industrialist. It was only after the ransom note was received that they realized that it was actually for money.
The kidnappers get no ransom. One is killed in a police shootout, and the others go to prison for decades. Is Watto the end of the run of kidnappings because it's perceived not to be worth the effort?
Watto's ransom was not paid. His kidnappers were foiled, one killed, one badly wounded, and the others tried and jailed. The French police considered that an end to the spate of kidnappings in France because it just showed it wouldn't pay. The police chief, Pierre Ottavioli, had this absolutely no ransom approach to kidnappings.
The police chief, Ottavioli, has this ingenious plan to arrest one of the kidnappers and then subsequently exchange the criminal for Watto. Tell us about this unconventional idea.
Pierre Ottavioli, a legendary figure in his own right, his plan was to lure the kidnappers to a rendezvous and to grab at least one of them. Ottavioli assigned a Eurasian martial arts master to immobilize the kidnappers with his bare hands. When he stopped his car along a highway where he was supposed to meet the kidnappers, a tow truck pulled up behind him to the emergency lane and thought he needed to have a tow. He got out of the car to wave him off, and then all of a sudden, two of the kidnappers kind of leap over a wall, jump in the car, start the engine, and take off with a fake ransom in the trunk. And they were immediately set upon by police cars, motorcycles. Ottavioli set this ambush to grab one of these guys and hold him hostage. There was a huge shootout. One of them was killed. The other, the head kidnapper, Alain Kyol, was badly wounded. He became their hostage. The police put pressure on him because if anything had happened to Watto, he would have been held responsible, and France still had capital punishment by the guillotine. They put enough pressure on him to make a phone call and have Watto released.
Big-time kidnappings require a large team to plan, assault, guard, and feed the victim. It isn't easy to find, motivate, and manage such a large group. People make mistakes. What happened?
It was really a motley band of thugs and car thieves and pimps and drug pushers and bank robbers. They had a powerful esprit de corps. They were loyal to Kyol. Kyle held them hostage in a way because he could have led the police to every single one of them if they abandoned him. They took a vote on whether to execute the hostage, and he was spared by a vote.
How did they come to choose Watto as their kidnapping victim?
They considered other people. They considered Marcel Dassault, the aviation industrialist, Liliane Bettencourt, the L'Oreal heiress, who's a heroine of my previous book, The Bettencourt Affair. Watto came to their attention because he was the subject of a number of investigative articles in the satirical weekly, the Canal Enchaîné, which pointed out that he fired a lot of workers. He was an easy target because he had very regular habits. They knew where he lived. His fancy apartment building on Avenue Foch, parallel to a service road. They figured a way to trap him in that narrow service road.
The initial police response to Waldo's kidnapping was mind-boggling. The police literally closed off the city, using roadblocks, searching for Watto, causing an enormous traffic jam. The thought that the capital city of a G7 country could be shut down over a single kidnapping seems incredible. Why did the French go to these lengths?
The Enpin Schneider group employed 150,000 people. The Enpin group was central to French economic and security interests. There was something of a panic, and there was concern. Also, leftist kidnappings and terrorist strikes were also taking place. The then president, Giscard d'Estaing, who was a personal friend of Enpin, was concerned because he was facing parliamentary elections in a couple of months. And he was concerned that the leftist coalition led by François Mitterrand was threatening to actually gain a majority in that election. They had to make every effort to find the Enpin and put a stop to this and make a show of force. This primarily motivated Giscard to order one of the biggest manhunts in French history.
There is a conflict of interest between the family and the state. The family wants Watto back. The state wants to end kidnappings for the future and is willing to risk Watto's death. Describe the conflict of interest on whether to pay the ransom.
The days immediately following the kidnapping, there was tension between the police position, which was no ransom, and the family's position, but they wanted to pay. The family members didn't know the state of Watto's finances. His daughters, who were then 19, the other 18, had a 13-year-old son. The kids said, okay, just sell a couple of companies and pay the guys. End of story. They didn't seem to realize that having a preponderant share of stock in the Enpin group didn't give him the ownership of all these different companies. And they didn't realize that his actual financial holdings were nowhere near the amount that was being demanded. Most of his fortune was in the form of stock. They couldn't pay the 80,000 francs, roughly equivalent to $70 million today. They came up with a plan to borrow some funds from the company and banks. They were able to put together a little more than a third of what was being asked for. And they were ready to meet the kidnappers, hand over that money, and hopefully end the story. What happened was the kidnappers, during phone exchanges, they said, you have the money? And he said, I have 30 million. And they said, no, it's 80 million. And they said, I'm sorry, you know, all we have is 30 million. That's a lot of money. You can have it. The guy on the phone said, tomorrow morning, you'll have a cadaver. And he hung up the phone. That was the end of the attempt to pay the ransom or part of the ransom. From that point on, the police position on no ransom payment.
Watto's financial situation is normal for a rich guy. The spouse and kids have no idea the level of wealth or how to monetize it within hours to fund the kidnappers' demands.
The kidnappers went barking up the wrong tree, and they just assumed because the Enpin Schneider group had annual sales of $20 billion, just take a little bit of that and throw it to these kidnappers. They had no idea of the difference between his personal wealth and the annual sales of the sprawling industrial group. To their mind, what, $20 billion in sales? He's good for it.
Another fascinating angle to the story is that Watto was CEO of the Enpin Schneider group. But the company took the position that the kidnapping was a personal matter, not a corporate one. If the CEO of Exxon had been kidnapped, I just can't imagine they would turn to the spouse and say, sell your stock or we'll give you a secured loan. I mean, Watto's last name is the same as the company's. Why did management tell the spouse to work it out on her own?
His number two, René Engen, a very good manager, saw his chance to take over the leadership of the group. Apart from Engen's personal ambition, the revelations about Watto's private life, his obscene gambling losses, his mistresses, and his privatisting apartments, was doing great damage to the image of the group. And it's going to be difficult to have shareholders accept that this very tarnished CEO would continue as before. Although the normal reaction would be, as you said, he's kidnapped because he's the head of our group. Let's bail him out. But it didn't work out that way.
Watto is held naked, chained by the neck to a wall, in a damp and freezing tunnel with a bucket to piss in. The press have Watto on the front page every day with new revelations leaked by the police about his multimillion-dollar gambling debts and his mistresses. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. How could the police have violated their duty to leak this personal information to the press in his most vulnerable moments? I mean, it's gross.
That's an excellent question. I was able to get to five of the police detectives involved in this case, and one who had his fingers in every aspect of it. He claims that they didn't intentionally leak. There were 80 detectives involved in the investigation. The press had a press office in the police headquarters at the time. So there was this fraternization between journalists and police officers. They go out and have a meal together and talk about all sorts of aspects of all the cases they were working on. And so probably in this unofficial, unintended, unfortunate way, some of these details just kind of leaked out.
The press got salacious photos of his mistresses from his secret tryst apartment. That doesn't sound like an unintended comment over a beer. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Watto was shamed, but this is France. I mean, the guy had gambling debts and a mistress. President Mitterrand had two families. Why the shock and horror?
This is France. I don't think that in itself would have been so devastating, but it certainly was to the family. It led to the destruction of his marriage and the breakup of his family. The gambling and the heedlessness would expose him potentially to threats and blackmail or indebtedness to the mafia. Some people said his finger was cut off by the criminal elements because of unpaid debts, which was not true. But this idea that left him vulnerable to manipulation by criminal elements, the gambling was really the main thing. But also the total lack of judgment that that shows. Do you want a guy running your a huge industrial group that has a monopoly of nuclear construction in France? Do you want a guy who bets a million francs and has these all-night betting competitions with Saudi princes and these casinos in the south of France? It's potentially a security breach and also a glaring lack of good judgment on the kind of person you want at the head of a big company.
Next topic, the pinky. Watto's kidnappers send the cops the top joint of his pinky in a formaldehyde solution hours after the kidnapping. With the Getty kidnapping, they sent his ear. Why the body mutilation when you could send a photograph with him holding that day's newspaper?
Well, when I asked the head kidnapper, Caio, that question, he said that they had made a game plan right from the beginning. How they'd grab him, where they'd take him, how they'd watch over him in this tunnel, the ransom that they were going to ask for, and to cut off the tip of his little finger. And I asked him why they did that, and it was not to prove that they had him. He said the stun effect. They wanted to stun the police, the family, the group, and show they meant business, to get their attention and show that they were ruthless, and with the threat of other body parts to follow meant time was of the essence, and that if the money wasn't forthcoming, things could get a lot worse than the tip of his pinky. It was just a conscious decision. This is serious. You guys better do what we say.
Another Getty snatch comparison is the kidnapper's remote hideout. It was impossible to keep the prisoner there for a long period. It was cold and damp. Everybody was miserable. Kidnappings put stress on everybody.
Absolutely. They expected this to be over in 2 or 3 days. They thought, okay, for a couple of days, the guys can hang out and eat canned food. And then it went on for weeks. And then after a month or so, people were grumbling, threatening to defect. And finally, they chose to move him to another place, which was an apartment in Paris. Then they moved him to a house in the suburbs, a little bungalow in the suburbs. Three or four of them just went AWOL. They said, we've had it. It's kind of like herding cats. They all had their own motivations, their own temperaments. their own degrees of intelligence. Kyle was very intelligent. Others were like borderline retarded. It was difficult to keep the group together over that long period. Kyle's told me they never planned for anything to go beyond 4 days. After that point, everything else was improvisation.
Family dynamics are challenging in the best of times for wealthy families. I mean, you saw Succession. Now with the kidnapping of the leader under stress, bad things happen. It's as if a bomb has been thrown into the living room.
The family actually is very divided over how to deal with this. First of all, the money really wasn't there. Wado's mother was a real piece of work, Goldie, former exotic dancer, stripper. She immediately remarried after her husband's death. Wado's father's impotent cousin, in order to retain her fortune and title, and she was just ruthless in pursuing her own interests. And then the first discussions about trying to gather the money for the ransom, she said, "I'm not going to pay a penny." Silvana, the wife, she offered to sell her jewelry. The kids just said to sell a few companies. Son-in-law, the husband of the eldest daughter, who was an American, wanted to jump in and seize control of the company by having Wado declared dead and then come in and take over. One of the effects of this kidnapping was to reveal the tensions in this family. The eldest daughter and the son-in-law were estranged from Wado after his release. Wado was estranged from his mother when he found out what her attitude had been. The wife, Silvana, it was kind of a mutual decision to divorce.
Next topic, Stockholm Syndrome and kidnappings. Patty Hearst was a teenager when she was abducted and ends up sleeping with her kidnapper and joining their terrorist activities. What happened with Wado?
It's a common situation during long kidnapping where a hostage realizes that his or her life depends on their relationship with their jailers. They try to get along, then they can be treated better, not killed, not tortured. Wado decided very early on to accept this with dignity and stoicism. He never complained about anything. They were amazed by his calm dignity, as they put it. And there's a way of manipulating kidnapped victims by telling them that we're your friends, that the ransom was not forthcoming. They don't care about you. They've written you off. They really hammered this home. The guys on the outside, they're the enemies.
Sort of like Bette Midler and Ruthless People.
Stockholm Syndrome, in this case, had a pretty strong effect. After he was released, he was immediately interrogated by the police. He gave them very little specific information about the kidnappers. He felt some strange, lingering sense of loyalty to his former jailers, to the point where he tried not to cooperate too much with the investigators.
I think this was a little bit more complicated. The jailers had threatened Wado that they would create violence after he was released unless he did what they said.
He feared that the kidnappers were going to come after him after he was released. They made him sign IOUs saying that he would personally pay them ransom. They even had him put his thumbprint on the documents. They would call him with a certain code word. That meant that he had to pay off within 24 hours. If he didn't do it, they would just shoot somebody at random in the street.
Was Wado angry with the police for ruining his reputation?
He was very bitter towards the police, and particularly the revelations about his private life, and they had not been particularly competent in liberating him. Two branches of the police that were involved. One was the investigative police. The other was the intervention squad, the commandos who showed up on the highway and took part in the shootout with the kidnappers. He respected them. They were the guys who were risking their necks. They were the heroes who led to his liberation. The ones who were back in the office pushing paper, making phone calls, he had much less respect for.
In the TV show Law and Order, the first half is the investigation and the second half is the trial. What was interesting about the trial? Boom, boom.
None of them were actually accused or charged with kidnapping. They were all charged with a sequestration or illegal imprisonment. Kyle attempted to present himself as an unloved child, a victim of a family that was not sufficiently supportive. He'd taken the wrong path and he knew he shouldn't have done it, but it wasn't really his fault. And then the judge cut him off after a couple of minutes of that. And that was pretty much the end of his defense strategy. Kyle had been caught and wounded on the highway. He couldn't claim that he didn't know anything about it.
Next topic was the judge's ruling about the evidence. In France, when there is an interrogation of a witness, a magistrate must be present. And anything said without the magistrate will not be evidence in court. And it turns out that during the discussion with the police, Callot is asked the question, why did you kidnap Wado? and he goes through his analysis of why Watteau was the perfect choice.
Yeah, that was fascinating. Cagliola was still in the hospital. He was exfiltrated to police headquarters, and they put pressure on him, and he might be facing the guillotine. If anything happened to Watteau, he should make a phone call and get him released, which he did. And after the police received word that Watteau had actually been released, Cagliola was still in the police chief's office along with six or eight other senior detectives. And this moment of victory, and everybody's feeling, okay, we solved this thing. We've liberated the Baron. The chief puts his legs up on the desk and he says, Cagliola, why did you choose Watteau? And of course, he had never admitted that he'd kidnapped Watteau. He said, we figured out he'd be easy to capture. And then all of a sudden he shut up because he realized he'd said too much. Now, none of that was theoretically admissible in court. The notes that they were taking, since there was no magistrate present, it's not a formal deposition. It couldn't be admitted into the court hearing. André Bizot, when the trial finally happened several years later, was assigned the role of explaining the investigation from the stand. No documents, nothing. The judges are saying, now, how did the interrogation proceed and what did you find? André Bizot pulled out the bomb and said, we asked him why he had done this, and he said this and this and this and this. So pandemonium, George Kiesemann, Cagliola's lawyer, jumps to his feet. Inadmissible, it's not possible. The judges then withdraw to the chambers. An hour later, they came out and they said, yes, it is admissible. It was just like the death knell for the kidnappers, because it was a strong indication that Cagliola had been involved from the beginning and admitted as much. It was a pretty important moment during the trial.
Watteau comes out of this experience a broken man. He leaves France, divorced, disillusioned, and he leaves with one of his mistresses. After 6 months, he's finding his footing and returns to Europe to reclaim his position in the company. How does the kidnapping affect the rest of his life?
He wrote his own memoir. It's an autobiography, but it mainly centers on this case and his experience and lessons learned. It had been kind of an enlightening experience. His values had been all wrong. He didn't appreciate things like family and just the simple things in life. He felt that somehow he'd come out of it a better person. Unfortunately, he never got rid of the gambling addiction and ultimately ruined him. And that's what gives it this Shakespearean or Greek tragedy aspect, which is that you're seeing the fall of a powerful man, not simply due to this unexpected event, but also due to his own flaws. And it's a cautionary tale about a man who threw caution to the wind. He was a victim of his own weaknesses and his own flaws.